I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush is reported to have chosen Alberto Gonzalez, a Texas confidant and White House counsel, to replace Attorney General John Ashcroft, who resigned yesterday. We'll have more on the Gonzalez nomination later in the program, but first, a spokesperson for the Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi says two members of Alawi's family, a cousin and the cousin's daughter-in-law, have been abducted. A group called Ansar al-Jihad is claiming responsibility, and they say they will behead the captives if the Iraqi government doesn't order all forces out of the besieged city of Fallujah and release all detainees in Iraq. Meanwhile, Iraqi rebels appear to be trying to open a second front in Fallujah, as U.S. and allied forces have now claimed control of 70% of that city, including two mosques and a commercial center. Charlie Daggett is a correspondent for CBS in Baghdad. He joins us on the line. And Charlie, to those hostages, can you tell us where and how they were taken, and has the government responded?
Yes, it happened yesterday evening. As a matter of fact, just an hour or two before the curfew that Prime Minister Iyad Alawi had set in Baghdad from 10:30 on, we understand that maybe half a dozen gunmen in three different vehicles came up to the house of the relatives of the Prime Minister, opened fire before even approaching the house, and were able to get away with his first cousin, 75-year-old Ghazi Alawi, and he's also, as we understand, a close friend, and his cousin's daughter-in-law. And as you said, there's already been this claim on the Internet, on an Islamist website from a group claiming to be holding these two relatives and threatening to behead them within 48 hours if the siege isn't called off in Fallujah and all of the prisoners are released from jails in Iraq.
Has the government responded?
The government has responded immediately after that. Prime Minister's office said that we will not give in to terrorists. He's actually point blank about it. So there isn't any question of giving in to the demands, if indeed they are as it appears.
Well, moving to Fallujah, we hear that fighting has been intense there today and that U.S. Marines and Iraqi brigades have seized two important mosques, but there are reports of minarets being destroyed in mosques, causing a lot of concern. You've heard about that?
Yes, I have. We spoke to the military in Fallujah about precisely that, and they issued a statement saying that they were fired on from the mosques, which is why they called in these airstrikes from that particular mosque, because once an enemy combatant uses a mosque as a defense and certainly launches an attack from that, then it's no longer a safe haven. But of course, you can imagine the fury this might stir with the religious community, not only in Iraq, but in the wider world. The mosques, they call Fallujah the city of mosques. It is a place that normally it would be hands-off. Even if they know that insurgents are inside, they're reluctant to go in firing. They'll do whatever they can to avoid damage. But in this case, clearly they felt that the danger was too high, and they called in the airstrikes, you know, these very dramatic airstrikes, in order to remove the threat.
Mm. Well, Charlie, we're also hearing today that Iraqi troops and U.S. troops have found hostage slaughterhouses in Fallujah. These are buildings where foreign captives were held and killed by insurgents. Is there any word whether British aid worker Margaret Hassan was held there?
Well, you know, the big question, when they said that they found the slaughterhouses, they say that the evidence that they've got there, they've got CD files, they've got paperwork, they've got documentation, including the names of the hostages. They also found the black clothes that the militants commonly wear in some of these videos that we've become too familiar with. I guess what we'll really need to know is if Margaret Hassan, if her image or if her name pops up in any of these slaughterhouses. We are in a war situation in Fallujah, and the Iraqis and the American military, we're constantly getting messages. Until we actually see something of proof, I think we always have to take this with a pinch of salt. But yeah, we really need to see names, and we need to see some evidence, because there's obvious concern about the well-being of Margaret Hassan. They've always felt that Fallujah was a haven for the hostage takers, for these these videos that we see and for the militants that are behind the executions. And this would bear it out if it is what it appears to be.
Charlie Daggett is a correspondent for CBS in Baghdad. Charlie, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat remains deep in a coma at a military hospital in France. Earlier today, a top Islamic cleric was at Arafat's bedside reading passages from the Quran. An aide said the PLO leader is in the final phase of his life. Officials say power is now being shared by Mahmoud Abbas, the secretary general of the PLO, Ahmed Korea, the Palestinian prime minister, and Rawi Fatou, the speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council. Well, Khalil Shikaki is director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research. He joins us on the line from his home in Ramallah. Hello.
Hello.
And I know you've been polling opinion and just plain observing your fellow Palestinians. How are they reacting to what seems to be the final phase?
I think to a large extent the public is taking it with a great deal of calmness. I would say surprisingly the public is going about its own business as usual. To a large extent, the presence of the president has not been felt for some time during the last few years, and his absence is not causing a great deal of disturbance.
Well, we, in fact, talked to reporters at Arafat's compound when he was moved, who were surprised at how little public reaction there was then. People seemed, according to some of these reporters, almost relieved that perhaps his leadership is passing. How have you felt the Palestinians' feelings towards Yasser Arafat ebb and flow recently?
Well, I think there is a lot of mixed feelings. On the one hand, he still, in the minds of the Palestinians, a man who embodies their aspiration for independence and statehood, a man who symbolizes their desire for national self-determination. But at the same time, he is also a man who has failed to deliver what most Palestinians wanted, and that is a state that is democratic, with strong public institutions, accountability, fighting corruption, and at the same time reaching a peace agreement with Israel that would end the occupation. In the two tasks of state building and ending the occupation, most Palestinians believe that Yasser Arafat did not do as well as they expected. And so there is a lot of criticism of the way he had managed the Palestinian Authority and the way he had managed negotiations. And during the last 4 years, we have seen a lot of criticism of these two failures on his part. Nonetheless, he is still seen, as I said, a man who is still the founding father of the national movement and the man who represents the aspirations for independence and statehood.
And you've written and said that many people were afraid to criticize him for the things that you mentioned because it would appear that they were, siding with Israel or the United States.
To a large extent, the fact that recently in the last 2 years, both the United States and Israel has begun to call for regime change and reform has caused a great deal of anger and frustration among Palestinians because a lot of Palestinians wanted reform. A lot of Palestinians wanted to see elections taking place that they believed Mr. Arafat did not make easy or possible.
Yeah.
But they didn't, at the same time, want it to be seen as siding with the United States and with Israel, fearing that if they do that, they lose credibility among the Palestinian public. So the move by the U.S. and Israel to criticize Mr. Arafat's governance record and to demand regime change, in fact, did a lot of damage to the cause of reform among Palestinians.
Well, his death is imminent. What impact will his death have on the Palestinians' feelings towards their government and towards radical militant groups such as Hamas?
Well, I believe that to a large extent, it all depends on what the transitional leadership will do. If the transitional leadership, which comes essentially from the old guard, if they immediately set up a date for elections, If they embrace the young guards and forge a coalition with them, if they are able to talk to the Israelis to so that the Israelis would show certain restraint during this transitional period, then I believe there is a very good chance that the process of transition will be smooth and the public will be willing to reward the old guard and the young guard, and that this will influence the outcome of elections, giving the nationalists a very good chance of forming the next government. But at the same time, if the old guard is to fail to do that, if they were to, for example, to refuse to set a date for elections, or if they refuse to embrace the young guards, then I believe that this could create immediate problems for them. Both the Islamists and the young guards are likely in this case to make the transition phase extremely difficult, using violence on the one hand against members of the old guard, particularly in the Gaza Strip, and certainly also using violence against the Israelis in an attempt to destabilize the rule of the old guard and show them impotent and discredit their ability to deliver to the Israelis.
It's been announced that Yasser Arafat's funeral service, when it takes place, will be in Cairo, Egypt, and that his burial will be in Ramallah at his compound, as opposed to initial requests by the Palestinians to have him buried in Jerusalem. How are Palestinians reacting to that move, to the burial in Ramallah?
Again, I think the Palestinians, the public, is showing a level of calmness that it looks like they will indeed go along with that. Neither the young guard nor members of the old guard or the Islamists have made an issue since this has been declared. And that, I believe, means that there will be no major problem with regard to the burial. This could have been a very difficult issue to resolve had the old guard or members of the old guard or members of the young guard have demanded that he be buried in Jerusalem. Given the opposition by the Israelis, this could have led to perhaps a bloodbath on the day of the burial that could have meant that the whole transition period might have not been able to recover from it. So the fact that he is being buried and that the public is accepting it and is willing to go along with that is certainly a very good sign for the old guard and for the transitional leadership that's in place today. But there is no doubt that the fact that he is buried in the Muqata, in the place where he has been imprisoned for the last 2.5 years, is helping in terms of for Palestinians to swallow the decision to bury him in Ramallah rather than in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the leadership has said that this is a temporary place for him until it is possible to bury him in Jerusalem, I think this is making it possible for Palestinians to live with that decision.
Khalil Shikaki, director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. Khalil, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Just ahead, Americans are increasingly heading north to buy flu vaccines and cheaper prescription medications. But Canada's health minister says we can't be America's drugstore. He's coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced this week that state health departments will decide which Americans get the country's remaining doses of flu vaccine. The vaccine shortage caused by contamination in a plant of the huge Chiron Corporation is being especially felt now as flu season approaches. Many Americans have gone to Canada for a protective shot in the arm, following the well-worn path of those heading north for cheaper prescription drugs. But Canada is beginning to re-examine its role as America's medical backup. Ujjal Doshange is the health minister of Canada. He's speaking today at Harvard Medical School, and he joins us. Minister Doshange, the Food and Drug Administration is trying to acquire up to 5 million doses of flu vaccine from other countries. Canada is one of them. Will Canada send the vaccines to the U.S. if a deal is negotiated?
I've spoken to Secretary Thompson with respect to this, and I've said obviously our priority is to make sure there is enough supply for Canadians, but if there's anything we could do to help, we would.
Well, in fact, we hear that a Canadian task force is suggesting that all Canadians over the age of 6 months be vaccinated against the flu. Do you have that much vaccine? And do you worry about, you know, maybe your neighbors to the south saying, wait a minute, could you spare some of that for us? I mean, that seems like a lot of people getting the flu vaccine.
We bought supplies larger than ever before for this year. We've immunized more people than ever before in terms of the percentage. We've immunized actually the largest number of people percentage-wise of any country in the world. And I know that there is a report saying we should immunize everyone. That's something we will consider, but that won't happen this year.
How do you feel, Mr. Minister, about Americans crossing the border or Canadians bringing vaccines south? We have a friend who just brought in 10 doses from Canada. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that there are two sources of supply in Canada. There is some private supply that's available. And I think that when Americans go, they are able to get access to some private supply. But, you know, there can't be sufficient supplies in Canada for 280 million Americans.
Well, in fact, this touches on the subject that you're going to be speaking about today at Harvard Medical School, which is the burden being put on the Canadian prescription drug system because of Americans going north. What will you tell the audience today about that?
I'm going to simply suggest that, you know, the priorities for us are the safety of the drugs. Number two, the adequacy of supply for Canadians. This situation can't continue indefinitely and cannot be allowed to escalate. And I believe that we have an obligation on our part to not fill those prescriptions because there is no particular appropriate relationship between a GP in general practitioner in Canada countersigning prescriptions from the U.S. You have to have an appropriate relationship with the patient. And obviously, these doctors that are doing this are bordering on the unethical. We need to also worry about the safety of the Americans that get those prescription drugs, whether or not they're being received in the state they ought to be received in after having been shipped.
You're also going to make a statement that I think is a pretty provocative one about, you know, Canada being America's backup.
We're your neighbors and we're the best of friends, but I think at some point we need to recognize that Canada is a small country and we cannot meet the prescription needs of 280 million Americans.
And we're wondering if your concern is that the entire healthcare system is getting overwhelmed. We're seeing reports in Canadian papers that the Canadian healthcare system, to remind our listeners, it's government-run, it's available to everyone, it's taxpayer-supported, that it's overloaded in other ways as well, that there's a shortage of doctors, dismal access to high-tech machines, according to one report, long waiting times for technology and specialists.
We have, I suppose, longer wait times for some of the non-emergency services, such as MRIs and, you know, knee replacements and hip replacements. But we are, in fact, doing something to deal with those issues. We've actually invested $41 billion Canadian additional over the next 10 years into healthcare to make sure that the waiting lines are manageable and reasonable.
Well, we should say we work with Canadians who say they've never seen any problems. But the criticisms that we've heard from a doctor that we're going to meet is that the government starts with a health care budget, pays out of that budget, and then scrimps so as not to run out of money.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, we meet the emergency needs of our people in Canada, and obviously non-emergency needs, you might have to wait a little. And those medical wait times have to be acceptable and reasonable, and I think that's where we're trying to go.
Yeah. Well, but still, and two hospitals in Ontario say they may have to cut 1,000 workers to erase a deficit. There's a study by the Fraser Institute that says Canada spends more than any other industrialized country providing this universal care, but it ranks low.
You know, absolutely not. In fact, In the U.S., per capita expenditure on health is about $5,000, and per capita expenditure on health in Canada is about $3,000. And your system in the U.S. pays about 30% of the total expenditure is cost of administration, and in Canada it's only about 17%. You obviously spend a lot of money, and you do some things well, but our health care is based on need, not on ability to pay.
But some people are saying maybe it's time for Canada to consider a parallel private health care system to go along with the national system?
I don't believe that there is much appetite on the part of Canadians for a two-tier system. We were there. We had a private system several decades ago, and we rejected that, and that's why we have the system. That, in fact, is the envy of the world in many ways.
Ujjal Dosanjh is Health Minister of Canada. He's in Boston speaking at the Harvard Medical School. Minister Dosanjh, thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to hear from a Canadian doctor who says Canada's system is already two-tiered, and he's striking out on his own, making his own deals with his patients.
Even if you're sick and you need six or seven visits a year, it would amount to something like about 1,100 U.S. or 1,000 U.S., something like that.
Also, as the siege of Fallujah continues, what happens when soldiers injured on the battlefield return home? We'll look at the war wounded on Veterans Day. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. British Prime Minister Tony Blair arrives in Washington this week to meet with President George Bush, their first meeting since Bush won a second term. The re-election of President Bush has posed some interesting challenges for Blair. Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb joins us now from London. Michael, what's been the reaction across the pond to Bush's re-election?
Well, Robin, it has turned everything here topsy-turvy in terms of politics. I mean, given how close the polls were, Prime Minister Blair didn't really know who was going to be calling last Wednesday with congratulations, although it's reported that he maintained regular video conference contact with President Bush throughout the campaign, and that's not surprising given the state of play in Iraq. But when Blair woke up on Wednesday and found that the early exit polls had been wrong and George Bush had won after all, he was faced with a bittersweet problem because, what you've got here in Britain is a prime minister, Tony Blair, from the Labour Party, who is now closer to a conservative Republican president than the leader of Britain's Conservative Party, Michael Howard. And this may hurt him at the next election. And that election is expected, I think, in May. I spoke with Trevor Cavanaugh, political editor of the Sun newspaper, which is Britain's largest selling daily newspaper, about this. He noted that Tony Blair is the last of the three main political leaders who staked their offices to go into Iraq to face his electorate.
We've seen John Howard re-elected with an increased majority in Australia, and we've seen George Bush re-elected with an increased vote in America. Tony Blair, by all the normal rules, should be re-elected with a very strong, if not an increased majority, when he stands in May next year. The chances are that he may find that the war is costing him more dearly than it's cost the other two.
The other aspect of the topsy-turvy nature is that it puts the Conservative Party, which, you know, in the 1980s really was joined at the hip with America's Republicans, Reagan and Thatcher were extraordinarily close allies. It actually has put the Conservatives on the back foot and actually trying to distance themselves from the Republicans.
Yes, this is the weirdest of developments as far as the Conservative Party is concerned. A lot of Conservatives are very unhappy with the fact that Michael Howard has openly declared war on the Bush presidency, has failed to welcome his re-election, and has made it very clear that he disagrees with him over the conduct of the war.
And Robin, it's so bad. Trevor Kavanaugh told me that Karl Rove actually told Michael Howard, don't come to America and expect to meet the president.
They were very, very cross. They were very cross because what they saw was that Michael Howard had challenged Blair, put his job on the line, by saying that he had misled the nation over the causes of the war. And that was seen by the president and by Karl Rove in particular as an act of disloyalty, not just to Blair, but to Bush himself.
So, but this is just remarkable. I mean, you have a conservative party. You know, I'm sure that on a whole range of issues, Britain's conservatives still are much more in agreement with Bush's Republicans than they are the other way around. And yet you have a White House that's willing to really push the conservatives away just on the issue of Iraq, forgetting the wide range of other issues that they probably have deep agreement on.
Yes, it's even worse than that if you think about it, because you've got Tony Blair, who's the leader of the Labour Party, which is viscerally opposed to everything that George Bush stands for, but is very, very close personally and politically to George Bush. And you have, and also, he's at odds with his own party as a result. You have Michael Howard, who should be, and in fact is a very strong Atlanticist, at odds with the president and with his own party over the same issues.
Here now is Michael Goldfarb speaking to the political editor of Britain's The Sun newspaper. And Michael, I'm thinking that this is all unfolding as British troops moved to Baghdad to replace U.S. Troops that have moved into Fallujah. With that assault underway, what kind of an effect is that having?
Well, it's not helping Tony Blair. In fact, it's got the country on edge. You know, what happened, Robin, is that the American commanders asked that the Black Watch, which is one of the legendary British regiments, be sent up to Camp Dogwood, which is just at the very, very outskirts of Baghdad's exurbia. And there was a great deal of concern about British troops being, you know, put into the heart of the Sunni triangle. And they've just been there a week and have already suffered 4 fatalities, which is more than they'd suffered in their previous deployment down south. The newspapers here are screaming about it. And, Blair is truly waist deep in the big muddy. I mean, he cannot escape the negative gravity of the conflict in Iraq.
Well, and some have always speculated that Tony Blair's firm backing of the war came with a quid pro quo. Now he's meeting with President Bush. What can we expect to happen in that meeting?
We can expect that there'll be an announcement of a revival of the effort to find a solution for the Israeli and Palestinian problem. That was put on the back burner during the long American election campaign. This was a pledge, we're told, that President Bush gave to Tony Blair, that Blair needed to have this pledge of renewed interest in finding a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem in order for Blair to sell going into Iraq to his own parliamentary Labour Party. We're expecting that. I think we can also expect to hear some reaffirmation from both men that elections will take place in Iraq. But again, you know, much fine language at these occasions. The question is, do deeds follow shortly?
If Tony Blair walks out of the meeting with President Bush with some sort of either peace plan revival or something tangible that he can hold up as a plum, will it make a difference to his political future?
Well, this is becoming a bigger and bigger question. As I said, Iraq really weighs heavily. It was not a popular war here. And the fact that the occupation and this transition period towards the establishing of an Iraqi government has not gone well, it weighs very heavily on him. And I wonder sometimes if the Labour Party plans to do to Tony Blair what the Conservative Party did to Margaret Thatcher in 1990 after she had won them a third election victory. And what the Conservative Party did is said, Margaret, you're out of touch, and they dumped her. So I asked another veteran political correspondent, Michael White, political editor of The Guardian, about this. The election is coming up in May, I wondered if he thought Blair would lead them into it. This was his answer.
It looks as if he's going to remain Prime Minister into the election. Unless something really bad happens, he'll fight that election. We'll probably win it. The question is how long he survives after that. But he does have now an irreconcilable element within his own party, but also on the Conservative-Republican side of the argument, which will never forgive him for what they regard as both the mistakes and the lies of Iraq.
So it sounds as if Tony Blair can win the battle, but not the war, because of the war.
Precisely. It's not an unreasonable surmise by Michael White to say, yes, Tony Blair is likely to lead the Labour Party to a third, unprecedented third consecutive election victory. But then I expect the nays to come out.
Here now is Michael Goldfarb in London. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, still to come, we take a trip on the Polar Express, the new animated movie that might revolutionize Hollywood filmmaking. You're listening to Here and Now. Sources close to President Bush say he's ready to name White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez to be the next attorney general. And Washington watchers say Gonzalez could face an uphill confirmation battle because of his record on civil liberties. Meanwhile, President Bush is praising outgoing Attorney General John Ashcroft, who resigned yesterday along with Commerce Secretary Don Evans, the first cabinet resignations post-election. But in his 4 years in office, John Ashcroft lost some allies inside the Bush administration because of his combativeness. At one point, he had this to say to critics of his anti-terror policies.
Your tactics only aid terrorists, for they erode our national unity and diminish our resolve. They give ammunition to America's enemies and pause to America's friends.
Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington University. So, Jonathan, Ashcroft is going. Gonzalez seems to be maybe coming in, but are other names still in the running?
There are other names. Probably the most significant competitor would be Larry Thompson, who is number two at the department. He would be an African American to be put in that position. Both of those elements are appealing to the president, either a Hispanic or an African American attorney general. Both of them would likely continue the thrust of Ashcroft's policies. I think that Thompson would likely have an easier time through confirmation, but I think both would get through.
Well, Alberto Gonzalez was Bush's Secretary of State in Texas and a good friend. What more do we know about him?
Well, Gonzalez has the ultimate card to play here. He has a very strong and close relationship with the president. If he really wants the job, I expect the president would give it to him. And more importantly, the president is comfortable with him. Gonzalez has a reputation for avoiding controversy, and he has also been named as a possible candidate for the Supreme Court. What's interesting is the degree to which Gonzalez balances his interest in becoming a Supreme Court justice with being Attorney General. If he goes in for the Attorney General, it'll probably knock him out of the race for the Supreme Court for a year or so. And so for him, there's a slight decision to be made there in terms of strategy.
And we just want to quickly mention that he also, Gonzalez, also publicly defended George Bush's policies on detainees and wrote a controversial memo on Abu Ghraib. So he is controversial.
Yes, that memo is very controversial because it suggests that American forces could violate the Geneva Convention, engage in torture, even violate federal law. And that is going to be a serious problem. But remember, John Ashcroft came with a whole baggage train of stuff and was still able to get through, and there's 55 Republicans in that Senate now.
Well, and let's speak a little bit more about John Ashcroft. What do you think his legacy is going to be?
I think that he will go down as a very polarizing figure, perhaps the most controversial American attorney general. In some ways, 9/11 played to Ashcroft's weaknesses. He became more general than attorney. And I think that he will not be looked on favorably historically. I think that he's had as many defeats in the court and in the court of public opinion as he has had victories. And it could have been so different. If he had shown a little more restraint, I think he could have become a conservative icon and would have been very, very popular. But instead, he adopted the most extreme and rigid positions in court, and that tended to alienate just not people in the public, but also a number of federal judges who really went after the Justice Department.
Well, in fact, he said in his resignation memo that America is now safe, and it is true that crime rates are down. But it is interesting that this week, the week that his resignation becomes public, is also the week a federal judge struck down the procedure for hearings for terror suspects at Guantanamo Bay. Just a couple seconds, your thoughts on that.
Well, he's actually had a number of very stinging defeats. Every year he would produce what he insisted were records of success in terrorism prosecutions, and every year we would find that the numbers were hyped. In one year, he included about 65 standard immigration cases that he counted as terrorism cases only because they involved Arabs or Muslims, and he eventually took those cases out. But there was this body count culture under Ashcroft that he wanted U.S. attorneys to give him those body counts of people that could be charged with terrorism cases. And it became almost laughable in the last couple of years as they really overhyped their successes. There weren't that many successes, and there were some stinging defeats.
Well, Jonathan Turley, we await President Bush's official announcement on John Ashcroft's successor. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
John Turley, law professor at George Washington University. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. One news item some on our staff are scratching their heads over concerns Aletta St. James, a 56-year-old woman who turns 57 on Friday and delivered twins yesterday by cesarean section at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York. St. James is believed to be the oldest American woman to give birth to twins. Little Francesca and Gian were conceived through in vitro fertilization using donor eggs. The new mom is a professional motivational speaker, and some of the parents here wonder how many motivational speeches she'll be giving to herself over the next few years, which will certainly include many sleepless nights, countless trips to the playgrounds, and then there's homework and college. Miss St. James, you're blessed, but take a nap while you can. The animated movie The Polar Express debuts in theaters across the country today. The traditional holiday story is the backdrop for some revolutionary movie-making technology. The Polar Express is the 1985 children's picture book about a young boy whose belief in Santa Claus is bolstered when a mysterious train appears at his house and takes him to the North Pole on Christmas Eve. It could happen. Chris von Allsburg, author and illustrator of The Polar Express, talked recently with Here and Now's Bob Oakes about turning his old-fashioned story into a high-tech film.
The book is known by parents and kids for its beautiful, vibrant illustrations. Were you concerned about how those illustrations would make the translation from book to film?
Well, a little concerned. I mean, my first concern was that they would that anyone would undertake to do it, because it's not always the case that a picture book is turned into a film, and the filmmaker utilizes not only the story but the aesthetics, the look of the book.
So you're pleased with the result?
Yes, I am.
Since it's radio and we don't have the benefit of still pictures, not to speak of film, we want to ask you, if you would, to try and explain the process that was used to create this film, the digitizing of this film.
Bob Zemeckis, the director, and his determination to make something that not only looked like the reality of the book, the setting of the book, realized that if he had to make characters that looked like they belonged there. And so he decided to use this fairly new technology called motion capture. And in this process, the actors have tiny little jewels glued to their faces, to their clothes, which in the case of the action is actually kind of bodysuits. But they wear these little jewel-encrusted outfits, and then they commit their performance in front of an array of cameras, which are called motion capture cameras. And the result is that these performances are the movements of those little dots. They are digital performances. But because of the number of dots they use, especially the dots on the face, it's the actors' expressions that actually drive, finally, the digitized character that appears on the film. So in that sense, it's not really an animated character, because there's a living, breathing human being who's giving this thing life. It's not It's not the artistic effort of an animator. It's the artistic contribution of an actor.
After the camera records all these little pinpoints of light, these what amount to sensors attached to the actor's body and the actor's face, an animator does go to work then and create the actual outline of the character and fill it in.
Yeah, you're right. He does have to, well, in a literal way, flesh it out. Because there are things on the human body that you can't attach a little sensor to someone's eye, for instance. So the movement of the eyes have to be done by an illustrator. But, you know, all the subtlety that that's part of human expression that conveys the thoughts or feelings of a character, those are very difficult for an animator. And in this case, it's really the actor who's doing that work. It provides something very lifelike, but it is also in subtle ways not lifelike, and that seems to me to be appropriate for the story, because even though the story at the end, there is a suggestion that the boy did not have a dream, he had a genuine experience, it still has a dreamlike quality, the story has, the book story.
Are there any minuses?
Well, I suppose there are, because even with all those sensors on the face, there's sometimes the faces, well, specifically, it's very hard to do hair. Hair blowing in the wind, it turned out to be an immense challenge.
Tom Hanks plays a number of roles in the film.
That's right.
Explain that, if you would.
Because he can become a digital sort of engine for performance, he can put this suit on that has the little dots all over it and also has these applied to his face. Then he can basically commit his performance in front of the motion capture cameras. They can, at the same time, basically do a body scan of a young boy. So the young boy's shape, his envelope, so to speak, is recorded in the computer. And then Tom, in the same way a hand might go into a sock puppet, they can take Tom's performance and slide him into the body envelope of the boy.
So in addition to playing Santa, he plays the kid.
He plays the kid, and he plays the conductor. It's in the conductor's role that people will recognize him. In those other parts, he's the engine for the performance.
All aboard! This is the Polar Express!
So is the film true to the book? Are there characters created for the film that weren't in the book?
Oh, sure. You know, the book's 32 pages, and it's a simple story. So naturally, in order to create an interesting film narrative of 95 minutes, things were added. You know, I accept the reality that that a picture book, which is providing essentially a premise or inspiration to a group of artists and filmmakers, that's going to change when they undertake to make a film out of it. And my hope is that the inspiration I've provided them will lead them to creating a successful film.
You're about to be involved, as I understand it, in a reading initiative through the National Education Association, in which you're going to broadcast live from Boston to school children in 97 theaters across the country. Explain that, if you would.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? There's a chain of theaters, Regal Cinemas. And they have provided screenings to schools that are located near their theaters, their multiplexes. And I'll be in a studio in Boston with a live hookup so that they'll be able to ask me questions.
Is the Polar Express going to become the Rudolph, the red-nosed reindeer of its time?
Well, that would be gratifying to me if it did.
And you're not concerned about the story becoming over-commercialized?
The one thing I'm worried about, I'll confess, is that this film, like all films for children, will have a DVD at some point in the future. And I know from experience going to book signings that I hear from parents and kids, you know, every Christmas we took this book out, or maybe every December 1st we take this book out, sharing it. That's a poignant image to me. And the possibility that people would forego that to boot up the DVD and watch it instead, that's slightly demoralizing to hear. I don't know.
Chris Van Allsburg, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Here now is Bob Oak speaking with children's book author Chris Van Allsburg. Chris, don't worry. The book is still going to be the best. The movie version of his book, The Polar Express, opens in theaters today. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer is Lindsay Crudell, and our interns are Jen Miller, Danielle Dreilinger, and John McAvoy. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.